beat goes on. The beat goes on.
He and his staff keep the games running on time and the media in line. Hardly an easy task. An Indiana native and a Purdue graduate, he fell into the task of organizing a stat crew for the Pacers when they were formed in 1967. Whether it was a converted restroom at the Coliseum, a cramped media room at Market Square Arena, or the luxurious facilities at Bankers Life Fieldhouse, his group has been churning out the play-by-play and box scores and manning the clocks and scoreboard for every game in franchise history. Even before that, really. It's not just the Pacers, though. He's also been in charge of operations for the Indianapolis Motor Speedway, the Colts, the high school championship games, and more. It's a labor of love because the pay isn't that great. In fact, in the beginning, there was no pay at all. But he didn't mind because it was fun back in the ABA days, not only during the games, but at the parties afterward. He's got stories to tell, so let's go. I'm Mark Monteith, and I'm going one-on-one with Bill York.
This is One-on-One with Mark Monteith on 1070 The Fan. Brought to you by Georgetown Market, Indy's family-owned natural food store since 1973. Movie Time Video Productions, they make your memories last forever.
Well, today on One-on-One, we're making a house call. We're in the living room of Bill York, and every media member in Indianapolis knows Bill York. He runs the stat crew for just about every significant sporting event in the city, and he has been the head of the Pacer stat crew, for example, back not only to day one, but I would say before day one, and we'll get into that in a minute. But Bill is about to begin his, let's see, Bill, how many years is this? How many years of the franchise is it?
Well, it started in 67.
So we'd have to do the math real quick. It'd be about the
48th
with the Pacers. So obviously we got some stories to tell. We'll get into that. Let's get into your personal background first. You grew up where?
Grew up near Peru, Indiana, and graduated from the old Bunker Hill High School, which is now known as McConaughey High School. They're south of, right by the air base. Graduated in 51, went to Purdue, was there for 2 years, and then went in the U.S. Army for 2 years, returned to Purdue, and finished my schooling in 1957, and come to Indianapolis, and have been here ever since. We started out with in February and March of 1957 at Stark and Wetzel, an old meatpacking company here and in Indianapolis, and been in the Indianapolis area ever since. We come down here, Jay and my wife, my son and daughter, both have lived here ever since then.
So when you went to Bunker Hill High School, how big was that school? How many in your class?
There were 32 in my graduating 32 class.
32 in your graduating class. Did you play sports?
I played basketball and softball. We didn't offer, Bunker Hill did not offer football or any contact sports like that. We didn't have enough people to man a whole team, really. But anyway, softball and basketball were my good sports. I played some varsity in my freshman year, and then later on, we had a pretty good team when I was a junior and senior.
Did you win a sectional or anything like
yes,
that?
Yes, we won one sectional. But Peru was always really a hotbed because they had Pat Malaska. I don't know whether you remember.
I do.
Pat Malaska, but he was their coach then, and oddly enough, was asked by him a couple of times to transfer to Peru, but
I tried to recruit
never,
you.
Huh? Couldn't get the farmer out of me. I just like milking those cows too well.
Did you grow up on a farm?
I grew up on a farm. My brother still lives on our home place, and we've got two or three other farms, and my family, my nephew, he raised about 25,000 head of hogs a year. So that's the Yorkers still pretty embedded in Miami County.
Yeah, okay. So Pat Malaska recruited you, though, to go to Purdue.
Well, him and a guy by the name of Smith that had this local sporting goods store there in town contacted me numerous times. Of course, I was always in the pool hall in Peru and and either there in the movie house. And so we had, and I lived with my aunt or stayed with my aunt on weekends in Peru. And so I was in contact and knew a lot of the Peru guys, really. And I don't know to this day why I didn't do it, because it seemed pretty intriguing at the time. And of course, I had a lot of chores at home that I was doing or being required to do with my brother and I. And so I never made the change.
Yeah.
Not really sorry for not doing it.
Yeah. So growing up on a farm, how did you begin your basketball career? Where did you play? You know, are you shooting at a goal on the barn here? Is this a classic Hoosiers thing?
We had a basketball goal on the outside of our barn, and we also had one on the second level of our barn so we could play inside. And Thanksgiving was always held in Christmas at the York Farm, and we always played basketball on Thanksgiving and New Year's and Christmas, and basically where we played was dependent on the weather.
Let's jump ahead. 1967, you're living in Indianapolis. You get the call to head the stat crew for the Pacers. The ABA is formed kind of over the winter of, like I'd say in January, February of 67. You know, the news of the ABA popped up, and the Pacers have a franchise. These investors kick in money here and there to form a franchise in the ABA. And obviously, when it gets around to the summertime, they realize, you know, we got to have a stat crew, got to put on these games. How was it that you got the invitation for that?
Well, that's kind of unusual. I had worked with a gentleman by the name of Bill Marvel, and he was with Sports Headliners, Chuck Norman's company that represented sports figures all over, both NFL players, NBA guys, located right here in Indianapolis. And Bill Marvel was one of those people, and part of the Chuck Norman's involvement with the Pacers was that he would furnish the public relations and those kind of things.
You mean Chuck Barnes, right?
Chuck Barnes, yeah. I'm sorry, yeah. Not Chuck Norman. Chuck Norman's my neighbor out here in the construction business.
Okay, yeah, Chuck Barnes.
Chuck Barnes and his brother. So Bill Marvel called me one day and says, "My gosh," he says, "I'm getting all this stuff from the league office," and he says, "I'm not being a basketball player." He says, "I have no idea what a FGA or an A or a turnover." He says, "You're going to have to come in here and help me get this thing squared away." So that was the first involvement of putting together a stat crew, of which I did. And ironically, there's only two of us left on that in the initial group. And
yeah,
I suppose that the next thing we want to call is about the call out.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Your first duty heading up the stat crew was to keep the stats for the initial call out. And this is, I think, in June of 67. And they had an open tryout.
We had an open tryout at the Coliseum, and we had 157 people, including a friend of ours from Kokomo, Indiana, Jimmy Rail, Ron Bonham, and a couple of other guys, and a lot of the Big Ten guys, Jimmy Dawson from Illinois, and Matt H., and Oliver Darden from
Michigan State, Michigan.
And Michigan State, and George Peoples long later from Iowa, and we just a bunch of Big Ten guys were involved in this call-out. And the three guys, Larry Staverman was our coach. Mike Storn was the general manager. And Larry Staverman had two guys helping. One of them was Slick Leonard, and the other one was Clyde Lavellet from the old Terre Haute area.
Yeah, Lavellet played on Kansas's national championship team. He's, in fact, in the Hall of Fame as a player.
And Slick on the 53 championship team, where he made one free throw and missed one free throw and won the championship. We always give him heck about missing that.
Yeah, he choked on the first one, didn't he?
And so he won't talk about that. But anyway, those three guys helped loan those out, and them cutting people was kind of simple. It didn't make any difference if the guy had hit five shots in a row or not, but they were pretty good judge of Pacers. And course, they had the nucleus of our five guys, headed up by Roger and Freddie, and it was about two or three days in a row that we had this call-up.
Slick talks like he just ran him and ran him and ran him and kind of dared guys to show up for practice the next day. Do you remember it that way, as being a really demanding thing?
There were so many guys that had sore muscles and going to the bathroom and regurgitating it was just, it was kind of unreal. Yeah. Yes, they did run them.
Yeah.
And everybody who is not in very good shape at all didn't last very long.
Now, did the guys who had contracts, guys like Roger Brown, did they have to participate in all of this too? And or were they kind of exempt from some of the strenuous
They were
stuff?
Involved in it, but at a much lighter rate. They didn't spend much time with those guys. They were, as I recall, down to the other end of the floor shooting, and they were preparing these other guys as rookies, and not too many of them lasted.
Yeah. So out of those guys trying out without a contract, who made it? Who emerged from that group to actually make the first team?
Well, the one that I remember is Jimmy Dawson from Illinois.
Mm-hmm.
And Jimmy came in and did a really good job. And
Jerry Harkness, I think,
Jerry
emerged.
Jerry Harkness was one of the guys that stuck with our team. And so it was really an enlightening situation to get started. Larry, we didn't do very well. Not too many of us thought that Larry Staperman was the best coach in the world. So in the second year, Slick came in and Mike Storn hired him, and things drastically changed.
Yes, they did. Yes, they did. Now, when you're watching and keeping score for these open tryouts, did you think like, hey, this thing might last? You know, I mean, Indianapolis might have a professional basketball team for quite a while here, or were you thinking, oh, this thing isn't going to make it?
All of the media, both the local and the national media, were very skeptical about the ABA. And, of course, the NBA, they were terrified by the ABA and thought they were about as low-life people as you would ever want to walk around. And then when Slick got there and got the minds of everybody that they could win a couple ball games, it totally changed. And then after a while, you had a few NBA teams come in, and we had some exhibition games, and a couple of them we handled pretty well. I think there's where the transition was made, and Coliseum become a afterthought, and we started thinking about a new arena downtown, and Mayor Luger and all those people that were involved back then certainly helped instigate those transitions from the old ABA to the real ABA.
And the beat goes on.
York relives the glory days at the Coliseum, where they turned a restroom into a press room, when One-on-One continues. Welcome back to One-on-One. Mark Monteith here with the man who runs the press rooms throughout Indianapolis, Bill York. The working conditions for the media at the Coliseum weren't the greatest, but they did have fun. During the games, and especially after the games. Let's just say it was good to know the mayor.
Charleston was once the rage.
Tell me about the stat crew. Like, how many people were on your original stat crew?
The original stat crew was 11. I had 11 people.
And this is all volunteering, right?
At that time, it was all volunteer. Nobody was getting paid. And we were all doing it for the love of basketball. And basically, it was something different. And it was something that was big because we had some really big crowds at the old Fairgrounds Coliseum. And basically, the fire chiefs and everything. About every other day you read something in the paper how the fire chief was going to close us down because we had too many standing room people in the arena, and we'd have anywhere. As I recall, there were very few games that we had less than 5,000 or 6,000 people there.
Yeah.
Of course, Coliseum at that time, the maximum attendance was something around 11,000.
That was with standing room, yeah.
Yes, yeah. Yes. And so the fire department was there all night. But back then, everybody was energetic and about the Pacers. I don't think they thought too much about the ABA, but they were enthralled with the Pacers and watching Roger and Neto, and then eventually Mel, Slim, we called him, Mel. Mm-hmm. Later, George McGinnis and some of the other guys got along with Fred. Just Freddie was probably about as good a point guard as you'd ever find. Mm-hmm.
Underrated player, in my opinion.
Even yet today.
So. Yeah. It seems like there was just a real kind of a civic hunger for something big at that time. You know, because Butler basketball was the biggest show in town until the Pacers came along. And, of course, high school basketball was always big. But it seems like there was just a real hunger among the city to have something professional and something national.
My thoughts are that the administrations of the city government and really the state government being located here as a state capital and everything, I think it became a very good society thing myself. I mean, back then there was no football. High school football wasn't what it is today. It was just a societal thing to attend a Pacer game because it was the only game in town.
Yeah.
And it just become a place where people wanted to go.
So your original stat crew, you didn't have computers then.
No. Nope.
How did you put all this together, and how did you get the information out to the media?
Everything was done by hand and phone back then, initially, because we didn't even have fax machines back then. And we had in the old Coliseum a 15 by 15 retired restroom for a press room.
The former restroom, 15 feet by 15 feet, that's the press room.
That included the urinals and the toilet.
So, like, were these, like, out in the open? I mean, were if you had to go to the bathroom, I mean, do you have any privacy? Or
not in that press room. There was a ladies' room right across the hall. This used to be the men's room.
Uh-huh.
And we set it up in there for Dave Overpeck with the Star and Dick Denny with the News, were the original
beat writers
for the local papers. We set them up a table, and they sat right next to each other. We had, as I recall, we had two phones. We had one out on the press bench and one back in the press room. And we'd call some of the, you know, if there was a big game, like we were playing Kentucky, it seemed like sooner or later the national people got there. We didn't have an ESPN back then.
We didn't
have TV. It was just basically radio and print media. So those we tried to cover. Well, then just a little bit later, Bob Laycock was my press room manager. And Bob was my boss at the Speedway, and I was his boss at the Pacers.
Okay.
I typed the running account. We typed it.
So you sat courtside with a typewriter and typed a running account.
We put down the time at a basket was attempted or scored. Then we'd go over, and it would be 15-foot jump shot, assist from Freddie, or one of those things, and a descriptive running account or play-by-play, as we call it today. So it was different.
Yes, it was. And one of the differences was that you really kind of had a family atmosphere with the players and coaches. I know you guys socialized a lot together. Of course, you would travel all over the state for exhibition games and even some regular season games with the team. But from what I always hear, you guys had a real kind of a family atmosphere or kind of a connection with the players and coaches back then.
Slick and Nancy Leonard wanted it to be a family affair. They were so involved with the whole stat crew and the whole family of Pacer players because A lot of the guys had wives and families. Johnny Barnhill, his wife had, I think, three children already. Clark Kellogg later on had three or four. And ironically, I like to talk about those guys because all the kids from the Pacers, they learned to swim in my backyard pool here at the house. It was really a family affair. We'd have some of the wildest New Year's Eve parties with all of the Pacers.
So all the players.
All the players, their wives. Not too many kids there.
Yeah.
But all the, what we call Pacemates today, if we had a couple of those Pacer girls and the ball boys and the mayor and some of his staff and a lot of the police guys that worked security out the field house or out at the Coliseum.
It'd all be over here at your house.
All would be at either my house or Fremsky's.
Okay.
It got so big we had to move out of Fremsky's house because the basement got crowded. One of the things that everybody likes to talk about at one of the New Year's Eve parties, it was snow on the ground, colder than heck. And Freddie and Mel and Roger and Neto and all, they had machine guns.
Machine guns.
Yes. And they were out in the backyard and shooting up in the air. And all the limbs were falling out of the trees and everything. And all of a sudden, here comes we hear police cars coming toward our place. And we had no idea they're coming to ours or to party. But they showed up. Well, the mayor and the couple of police guys were already there, and they had everything well under hand. But
it's good to have the mayor at your house.
It was good to have Mr. Hudnut there at the house to kind of refrain from getting us all arrested and thrown in jail.
York recalls the days when the Pacers always had a fighting chance. When One-on-One continues. Back on One-on-One, I'm Mark Monteith. Bill York's stat crew kept track of everything that happened in the basketball games, except for the fights. They didn't score those, but they did enjoy them. Here's York, starting with one of Mel Daniels' classics.
Mel Daniels and Bob Verga with the Pittsburgh team.
A fight.
They got in a big fight, and Bob Verga decked our Mel Daniels right at the free throw line.
I was at that game. I remember this.
And this is something Slim doesn't like to talk about today, but we always give him heck about it. Because Bob Verga wasn't any bigger than a hill of beans.
Right, he was a guard.
Yeah, he was a little guard, about 5'10", no more than 6 foot. He just decked Mel just big time.
Now, Mel says he was off balance, and that's the only reason. But the thing I remember about that is that at halftime, Mel followed the Carolina players to their locker room. He was going to resume the fight at halftime, but Bones McKinney got in the way and kept it from going. But Mel was ready to resume it because he was a little bit embarrassed by it. But.
Oh, yeah. I'm sure, and I felt so bad for Mel back then, but it was – and at this later date, it really becomes funny because we always talk to him about it, and he gets. The other incident happened up in Kokomo, and there was a big crowd there, I can remember. And we had a guy, one of our big centers called Reggie Harding.
He played about 23 games the first year of the franchise.
And he got in a fight with Byron Beck from the Denver Rockets or Nuggets
were then. First year they were the Rockets.
And he swung at Byron Beck and decked him out in the middle of the court. he turned and ran off the court, ran to the dressing room, and we haven't seen Reggie since.
No. He was a seven-footer who was really a talented guy who had come right out of high school practically to play first in the NBA and then came to the Pacers. Really a talented guy, but a troubled guy, too. So he stopped showing up to practice.
You could tell that schooling hadn't been his number one priority.
No. He suddenly came up missing for practice and games and finally was just released toward the end of that first year, but had some really good games.
He carried two books around in his satchel and a gun, a handgun.
A gun. Now, think about this now. He would get on a flight, a commercial flight, with a gym bag with a gun in it, a loaded gun, and it was no problem. And Jimmy Rail tells the story. They were roommates on a trip to New Orleans one time, and Rail wakes up, and Reggie's sitting on the other bed pointing a gun at him.
I heard that story.
Yeah. I mean, think about that. You know, a player today, you get caught. If you get stopped for speeding and you have a gun in your car, you're in huge trouble. And he was taking guns on road trips.
Things were a little bit more loose back then.
They were a lot more loose. And speaking of Mel and a fight, I mean, it seemed to me, I'm sure it wasn't really like this, but it seemed like there was a fight just about every week. Somebody was in a fight just about at least once a week.
The ABA was a very competitive league.
Yeah.
Yes, we did. We had a knockdown drag up in Lebanon with the Kentucky Colonels. And I think there were about three or four guys that were ejected from the game up there. And it was, you're right, Mark. There was many times when we had pretty good licks.
There had to be, and a lot of times you talk about people getting ejected. It had to be a bad fight because a lot of times if there was a fight, there would be no ejection. You know, like they would just stop it, calm everybody down, and play would go on.
Wendell Ladner. Wendell Ladner played for three or four of the ABA teams, but everywhere he went, he instigated fights. But we all got to like Wendell because he was a good kid and everything. And Doug Moe out in Denver, he was a instigator a lot of times, him and
Larry Brown was
protecting Larry Brown, so
yeah,
he got by with it.
Do you remember the fight when the Virginia Squires were here and Al Bianchi was the coach and the police got involved and some guy spent the night in jail?
They took him down to jail, and then when we went to Virginia, they kind of tried to reciprocate and didn't get by with it. Slick got out of the gym and was gone before they could get him. But and the same thing happened down in Louisville with the Colonels. The police escorted some of our guys out of the gym. I don't think we ever ended up – they didn't end up in jail, but they sure were escorted out of town.
Another thing about the ABA was that you really had a pretty good relationship with the referees. I mean, the referees would come to these parties, right, and socialize with you?
Yes, they were. We drank with them and everything. They drank with us. And one of the guys, and I can't remember, maybe you could help me out on this. We had one of the officials had been an official in the roller derby. And somebody from the Pacer organization, but one of the fans, hung a likeness of him in effigy behind one of the basketball goals one night at the fairgrounds.
The Coliseum, yeah.
And I can't remember the gentleman's name, but he was a very antiquated guy, but he had refereed for roller derby and everything, so he was a showman without a doubt. But here you can recall a time that Slick grabbed Wally Rooney around with a big whistle around his neck. Well, shoot, we all, after the game was over, they were down at the cafeteria with us drinking beer, and they were having a good time just as well as we were.
Now, when did you start getting paid for your services as a chief?
That's a good question. I can't remember, but I can remember that I broke it down for the stat crew, and some of them got $5, and a couple to it was a clock operator and an official score, and myself, I got $7. So it was $5 and $7 a game we got paid. And I would guess that was probably 5 or 6 years into the
Oh, so you might have done it for free for like 5 years, huh?
Yeah, at least that.
That's interesting because Tom Carnegie told me that he didn't get paid for being the Speedway's public address announcer until, I think he said, sometime in the 1960s. Like, he did it for 20 years for free. People wouldn't do that today, so I think it says something about your generation that people, you know, here's professional basketball. It's all about making money. The players are getting paid, and you're doing this for free just to help keep the thing going.
Well, this is one of the things that I really want to convince the many, many of your listeners that this was a time when you could depend on people. And I depended on all these people, as did the Pacer office and the administration. And we had a group of people that they lived and died the Pacers. They didn't care what else there was to do, but this was our life and the lives of all our kids and everything. So we really didn't think much about the monetary aspect of it until I think Mike Storn instituted it, and my guys, we thought $5 and $7 a game, man, we can party all night with that.
You but, could buy three or four beers with that.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Oh, you could buy at least that many beers with that kind of money.
York helped celebrate a championship with his clothes on, unlike some people, when One-on-One continues. Grandma's sitting in chairs and reminisce. We're back on One-on-One. Mark Monteith here with the man who runs the Stat Crews and press rooms all over Indianapolis, Bill York. He and his group have worked a lot of events beyond Pacer games, but those have always been the focus. The job got more serious when the Pacers entered the NBA, but still, after all these years, it's about more than basketball. Pacers' three ABA titles were all clinched on the road. 1970 was in Los Angeles. 1972 was in New York. You weren't at those games, of course, but in 73, they won Game 7 in Louisville to win the championship again. Now, this is just down the road, basically, so you guys all went. What do you recall of that 1973 championship?
Well, there's a couple of things. Number one, I was busy working at Speedway.
Yeah, we'll talk about it. You also run the Speedway presser.
I worked at the Speedway up until a certain time, and then we all took off to go to the what we knew was going to be the final game, and we were going to win it. So we all got rooms down at the Executive Inn at the fairgrounds there in Kentucky, and we won it. Mm-hmm. We won it big time, and Bill Keller hit some big shots, and
George McGinnis was the series MVP.
Oh, yeah. George, we just took it to him. And, of course, after the game, we were going to party. And we went back to the Executive Inn and was partying late into the evening, and somebody suggested that we ought to take a little swim. So there was a big fountain out in front of the Executive Inn down there, and a fountain with a pretty good size pool of water around it. So we a lot of us got on almost totally undressed and got in the fountain.
Women included.
There was a couple of girls that got down to the skivvies, and a couple of guys were just really having a good time. And Babe McCarthy, I remember one of the old ABA coaches, good friend of Slick's, was there, and we just partied all night there and had a heck of a good swim.
Now, this fountain, is it in the lobby of the hotel or outdoors?
It was outdoors.
Okay, out in front of the hotel.
It was outdoors, and then it was back in May, because I was at Speedway, so it was in May. Mm-hmm. But as I recall, the weather was not a can't remember whether it was cold or not. I guess. The water was fine.
Now, I'm guessing, though, that it was the players weren't involved in this because they all probably had gone home, right? They took a bus down there, I know, for that game, so they probably had gone home.
No, there were none of the players there. It was just all the stat crew and Slick and Nancy and
front office people.
And front administrative people at the Pacer office. And Bill and Marge Donnell were our first public address man. But it was an all-night party, and I don't even recall coming back to Indianapolis. could have been a week later.
You made it back eventually.
Yeah.
How did things change when you moved to Market Square then? I think, see, we're talking, what was it, 75, I believe, that the Market Square Arena opened?
Yes. Everybody was so elated to have a really new place to play basketball. And, of course, we'd won the championships. And, of course, everybody was talking merger and all that good stuff. And we kind of felt that the Pacers were here to stay. We really felt that at that time everybody had made the grade. We were ready to take on the NBA.
How did the atmosphere change, though, once you became a member of the NBA?
You know, it did. It really, I think everybody raised their thoughts a level, and it became a very important game. In other words, every game that we played with an NBA opponent was big. It was, well, much like it is today, really. The transition was that every game was very important.
More businesslike, less freewheeling.
No more overnight parties and things like that.
No more jumping in the fountain.
No more fountains and everything. But one of these days, and we're getting close, we're getting awful close, and we're going to have another championship here in Indy, and I feel it.
Yeah.
I just feel that the group of guys right now that are on the Pacer roster are – dedicated individuals, and they're pretty hungry.
Yeah.
And I think that's what it takes to take care of some of these teams that are so dominant.
We should talk about your other activities. Now, you go back, how far do you go back with the Speedway?
Well, I graduated from Purdue in 1957, midterm, and in 1957 in June I got married and had a job at Stark and Wetzel, and one of the things that Stark and Wetzel did was we started the rookie of the year at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. Well, that kept me busy on April and May away from my office at Stark and Wetzel, but I still do that today. It's of course registered by Chase Bank now. The rookie there, we've had three different sponsors of it, but I've been involved with it ever since it started.
The Rookie of the Year Award.
Yes. And
how long have you been in charge of the press room out of the Speedway?
Well, I was first started out there with Bill Marvel and Bob Laycock and Al Blimker. In 57, I knew them, and I become probably one of the most popular people at the Speedway back in 1957, because I used to, and along with the Rookie of the Year program, we used to provide them and a lot of the other drivers out there with lunch meat. So I would drive down the middle of the garage area and pass out lunch meat, because back then all we had in the garage area was a refrigerator, Colonial bread, Dean's milk, Robert's milk, and Bill York brought out the lunch meat. So I was an important guy in my little blue company car. And
sure.
So I started then in 64 at the Speedway in the media center area with working the whole month. My boss at CHL's, Bud Ellis, who was Mr. Ellis was potentate of the Murrah Shrine in 65, and he was very active in the 500 Festival, so he let me take the whole month off in May. But ironically, May was one of my best business months, too. I wrote more business by people coming to the Speedway than I did if I was out calling on them.
But, they knew where to find you.
They knew where I was, and it became a ritual that the whole month of May become a tradition. We've gotten away a little bit away from that, but we're kind of getting back to it again. Then when Bob, Mr. Laycock, was a little bit older, and he passed on the gauntlet of Media Center manager, and I was Media Center manager at Speedway for approximately 30 years.
You do the state finals too, right, your crew?
Oh, we've done the
basketball,
girls and boys, ever since they moved to Market Square Arena. And,
mm-hmm.
and we've done all the class football finals at Stadium or Hoosier Dome or
mm-hmm.
RCA Dome or whatever you want to call it.
Do you, looking back over these years of Pacer games, are there certain games that stand out that are highlights for you, all the games you've seen?
Probably the highs and the lows, Mark. In other words, one of my less enlightening things that has happened to me in my life, I've been asked to move off the Media Center bench twice.
By referees. Because you're yelling too much.
Well, I didn't yell at him. Oh. I just, one of them I got, I think I was smiling at him, and he didn't like my smile. But Joe Gashue and Earl Strom, and like all of us we enjoyed those guys. So it was about half and half. They were just raising Cain with me, and I was raising Cain with them.
And they tell you to move, huh?
One time, Jerry Baker was, I was standing behind him, and I don't know what I was doing, but something that the ref didn't like. He came over, he started over there, and I saw him when he was coming, so I grabbed a phone, and I got on the phone and kept talking, and he had to stand there till I sung the phone up, and then he asked me to leave. So those are less enlightening parts of my career, but they were all in fun and that. But watching Slick throw the ball rack and once on a bad call, and but the championships and certainly all the friendships of both of my stat crew and the game day officials and all the players and the officials, and it has really been a family situation that has been very enjoyable.
Yeah, so what does it mean? You know, obviously it takes on a meaning beyond basketball for somebody like you who's been to virtually every home game that the Pacers have ever played. You keep the stat crew people together for so many years, and you and Bill Bevan go back to the very first year of the franchise. What does it mean to you now? You know, it's got to have a meaning just beyond the games.
I think that you hit it. The nail on the head. Yes, it's a business, and we feel that many of us have had an important part in building this franchise, and you don't want to see it go backwards.
One-on-One with Bill York continues in a moment. All right. Thanks to Bill York for joining the One-on-One Alumni Association. He and his staff are awfully well known to media members around Indianapolis. I realize fans might not know of him, but hopefully his stories held your interest. Those early ABA days were indeed a special time for the people who lived them. Life was simpler then, looser too. For example, a guy could get into a fight without being branded a thug. And the people involved in the games, players included, got together afterwards to party. Can you imagine what would happen today if players fired machine guns into the air on New Year's Eve? It'd take more than the mayor to get them off the hook for that. I can tell you from personal experience that Bill and his crew are really good, down-to-earth people who take their job seriously, but not too seriously. And I don't think they do it for the money even today, because it still doesn't pay that much. Although it is great to be able to sit courtside. A year ago, there were three members of the original stat crew still working the Pacer games. But Paul Foremski, the original timer, passed away last winter. So that leaves Bill York and Bill Bevan from the original crew. And another man, Bob Bernath, is right behind him in terms of service on the crew. I doubt there's another team in the NBA that has three stat crew members who go back more than 45 years. Now, if you want to hear this or any of the other one-on-one conversations, all you got to do is go to 1070thefan.com. Click on Shows, click on One-on-One, and the podcasts are waiting for you 24 hours a day. You can reach me by email at mark@1070thefan.com, and I'm available on Facebook and Twitter. The Twitter handle being @MarkMonteith. I'll be back again next week with yet another entertaining history lesson right here on FM 107.5 and 1070 The Fan.
And the beat goes on.
Yes, the beat goes on.
And the beat goes on.